ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening, this is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries, welcoming you to another one of our live First of the Month Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We're being heard tonight over shortwave radio station WWCR on transmitter 3 and 4. Transmitter 3 is 4.840 megahertz, and transmitter 4 is 5.890 megahertz. We're also being heard on radio station WBCQ out of Maine on 7.490 megahertz. And both of those stations do have their links to the internet live stream, or you can go to our website, kingidentity.com, K-I-N-G-I-D-E-N-T-I-T-Y, .com, and you can look down and see a live link from that page. If you would like to participate in tonight's program, you can call toll-free 877-924-7722. You can remember that by 877-YAWS-RACE. Once again, that's 877-924-7722. Our foreign listeners and also those of you who would like to call direct can use the number 678-949-5091. And I'll be announcing those later in the broadcast tonight. My guest tonight is a man calling all the way from England. He understands the state of world affairs from a racial nationalist viewpoint. He is especially well informed on the political and social situation in Europe. I'd like to welcome back to the broadcast the assistant editor of Heritage and Destiny magazine, Peter Rushton.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. I guess you're only a few days away from an election there in Great Britain. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the political situation over there?
That's right, Mike. We've got a general election scheduled for Thursday this week, May the 7th. Now, over here in the UK, the elections are generally roughly every 5 years. They're not on a fixed schedule like in the US. But what we have in common with the US really is that our democratic politics, the circus of our democratic politics, very rarely addresses fundamental issues. It becomes about personalities, it becomes about trivialities, it becomes about whatever the big money behind the campaigns drives the agenda in particular directions and submerges discussion on many questions. The big difference this time is that a new or fairly new party calling itself the United Kingdom Independence Party is threatening to break into the comfortable consensus. And they did extremely well in the elections to the European Parliament a year ago. One of their big issues is hostility to Britain being, to British politics being dominated by the European Union. This is a sort of mini version of one world order, new world order politics, where the politics of a nation are set outside its borders by forces that are that can't be by unnamed forces that are outside the control of voters and institutions here in the UK. Now, UKIP, as it's often referred to, the United Kingdom Independence Party, is challenging that agenda. To some extent, to a certain extent, there are many issues that they don't want to talk about, but at least they are beginning to break up the comfortable consensus to a certain extent. The electoral system here, however, is very much biased in favour of the establishment parties. So even though UKIP might well poll more than 10% of the votes, so 10 to 15% of the votes, possibly slightly more, they're unlikely to get more than a handful of the 650 seats in our Parliament, in the House of Commons. That's just because of the way the system is kind of rigged against them. We'll see on Thursday.
I heard part of what was billed as the last debate of your election, and the only people that were invited were the three establishment parties. Apparently, UKIP wasn't even invited.
Yeah, UKIP, despite having polled so very well last year, very often finds itself excluded from the agenda. There was one so-called leaders' debate that they were invited to, but the problem with that one was that all sorts of parties got invited to that. The Green Party, the separatist parties for Wales and Scotland, and so they were crowded out of the agenda to some extent. So they were either excluded or crowded out and not really given the status that their electoral support in the polls would really potentially give them. I suppose the closest in the US to the UKIP phenomenon was when Ross Perot was a challenger, or going further back when George Wallace was a challenger, when there were really strong third party campaigns. Here in the UK, we have three establishment parties. Labour and Conservative are the two big ones. There's a party called the Liberal Democrats who despite their name are a sort of centrist liberal party, to the right of Labour and to the left of the Conservatives. But those three, Lib, Lab and Con, as people often call them, are very much part of an establishment agenda. UKIP is the first thing to make any real breach in the wall to a certain limited extent, and therefore I think is to be welcomed, even though many of us would feel they don't go anywhere near far enough in challenging that consensus. At least it's starting to get people thinking outside the box, you know, thinking outside the frame, the artificial framework that's set for them by the establishment.
I guess that they at least pushed the Conservative Party into saying that they would have a referendum whether they wanted to stay in or out of the European Union.
Yeah, that's a very, very important consideration because, in my childhood, you go back to the 60s and 70s, the Conservative Party was the most pro-European of the of all of the establishment parties, and UKIP's emergence has dragged the Conservatives further and further towards a more Eurosceptical position, and so they have at least said that if they were in charge, and they've had to say this, they've not said it because they wanted to, they've said it because they had to try to block the leakage of support to UKIP from their own ranks. And so, as you correctly say, they have pledged a referendum if there were to be a Conservative government next time. Now, of course, all of that is very, very much in the balance, because as some listeners may have read, this election on Thursday, although it's been, UKIP aside, it's been a very dull campaign in terms of actual debate of the issues, it will, once the polling gets underway on Thursday, be in a sense an exciting campaign because it will be the closest election that Britain has seen really, I think, since 1974. So for just over 40 years, this will be the closest election that we've had. And I'd go as far as to say that it's now very, very unlikely that any single party will have a majority in the House of Commons. So it will be down to some sort of horse trading. The sad thing is, from our point of view, as you implied in your question, from our point of view, the ideal situation would be if the Conservative Party were dependent on UKIP in order to get into power, and that would hold them to their promises at least on the issue of a referendum on EU membership. However, sadly, I think that's it's not impossible, but that's quite an unlikely outcome. The more likely outcome is either that once again the Conservatives will be put into power with the Liberal Democrats in coalition with them, or that Labour will be in power with Scottish nationalist support. Now, this phenomenon of the Scottish nationalists is something that people outside the UK may struggle to understand, because these are Scottish nationalists, many of whose members were not born in Scotland, or whose parents were, you know, whose family hail from Pakistan or somewhere on the other side of the globe, but who now live in Scotland and support something calling itself the Scottish National Party. So it's a very, very multiracialist, liberal left-wing party on a whole range of issues, arguably to the left of the Labour Party. But they are, for a number of reasons, they are likely to poll quite well in this election, could have something like more than 40 members of Parliament, and therefore it's a fair bet that the SNP, the Scottish National Party, combined with the Labour Party and possibly the Liberal Democrats, will be the people that will have a majority. If that happens, then we can say goodbye to a referendum on the European Union. Whatever, that's been made fairly clear. So the Liberal Democrats are a very pro-EU party, so are the SNP. The Labour Party are more divided on it, but are committed to a left-wing social agenda and economic agenda. So I fear for what would happen after Thursday if there is a Labour plus SNP plus Lib Dem coalition. On the positive side, at least voters' minds have been opened to a certain extent to a broader range of possibilities. And so I think there will be outrage among more traditionally minded, more conservatively minded British voters, particularly in England, if they're faced with a Labour-SNP coalition that rules out a referendum on the European Union. Because that would really lock this country in to a whole range of political stances that have been utterly disastrous for British traditions, particularly on the immigration question, but on other matters as well.
What about the true nationalists in Scotland, the people who are oriented somewhat like our thinking? What are they doing? Are they supporting the Scottish Nationalist Party, which I understand is similar in their agenda to the socialists up there in Scandinavia?
Yeah, there's a degree of there's a split among racial nationalists in Scotland as to whether to welcome Scottish independence simply because it would shake up the system, or whether to resist it because of the factors that you mentioned, the facts that the SNP are of a left-wing stance. There's also the added complication that a lot of people of our way of thinking are, for historical reasons, strongly in favour of what's termed the Union, i.e. the Union of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And so this issue of the position of Northern Ireland for a lot of Scots comes into it, because what are termed, and I know there are a lot of people in the United States, particularly in the southern states, whose family heritage is what's termed in America Scots-Irish, or what's otherwise called Ulster Scots. So there is this cultural historical link between many people of our point of view in Scotland and their racial and cultural brothers in the north of Ireland, the Ulster Scots. And any weakening of the Union as far as Scotland is concerned might be viewed as having potentially disastrous implications for Northern Ireland as well. So many people of our way of thinking in Scotland are very, very disturbed about what the future holds for them and for our entire nation.
I was wondering, back when Northern Ireland was more of an issue in the news and they got sold out by the British government, why they didn't split off and become an independent nation.
Yeah, there was some years ago, dating back to the 1970s, there was an Ulster independence movement who said, in effect, because until the 70s, there was within the Union, there was an Ulster Parliament at Stormont in the north of Ireland that made a lot of decisions at a devolved level, at an Ulster level. And it was only because of the violence and the troubles instigated by the IRA terrorist campaigns of the 1970s that Stormont was set aside for many decades, and what was termed direct rule from London, from Westminster, was imposed. Now, in recent years, the devolved rule in Northern Ireland has been reinstituted. The problem is that the IRA forces there have now become so strong, in their political wing Sinn Féin, that Sinn Féin have a substantial share in power in Northern Ireland. That is the truly horrific and disturbing thing, because as with the SNP, only more so, because of course Sinn Féin have a heritage in actual serious political violence, serious terrorist violence. Sinn Féin's political stance is ultra-left-wing, ultra-multiracialist, ultra-liberal on a whole range of issues. They many people of Irish descent in the United States were lied to about this over many years, and rather naively and romantically saw Sinn Féin IRA as romantic nationalists of the old-fashioned type. In fact, the Sinn Féin IRA were very much part, were an ultra-violent version of the 1960s left, the 1960s civil rights agenda, if you like, given an ultra-violent spin. That's how they fitted in to the political spectrum on broader issues outside the question of Ireland. And
of course, the media is always spinning. They did it way back during the Spanish Civil War. A lot of Americans, and I'm sure Brits, went over there and fought for the left-wing communists, is what they were.
Yeah, and truly horrific things went on in Spain during that conflict between 36 and 39. Attacks on monasteries, destruction of Spanish heritage, really horrific attacks on civilians and women. That can barely even be spoken of during that period in a campaign of terror that was directed by truly demonic forces of international Bolshevism, which, as you correctly say, many liberals in the United States and in Britain and elsewhere in the world rather naively signed up to, in the belief that this was part of some wonderful democratic campaign that really was part of the democratic circus, and that's a fiction that is still talked about and still portrayed today to an extent. The wonderful democratic circus around the world, all these wonderful democratic forces. You remember Nelson Mandela's ANC, the communist terrorists at the ANC in more recent years, were similarly portrayed as being on the side of the angels.
Well, even the right wing in this country, so-called conservatives, such as Ted Cruz, went down on the same plane as Obama and paid homage to Mandela, and he also did it on his website. You know, and these are people who are supposedly conservative right thinking.
Yes.
What kind of input, if any, is the BNP and the smaller racial nationalist parties in Great Britain having on the current election?
Sadly, hardly any. This year's election, although it will be very interesting from the point of view of how UKIP, which is very much a sort of kosher nationalist party, shall we say, it will be very interesting to see how they do. In terms of a more solid type of racial nationalism, for two reasons, that has temporarily, I'm sure, faded away and will have virtually no impact at all at this year's election, despite the fact that if you go back 4 or 5 years, the BNP was itself making the headlines. And there are essentially two reasons for that. One reason is that, sadly, the BNP had within it, even when it was making its breakthrough at European parliamentary level in 2009, had tremendous structural flaws inside it, associated with its then leader, Nick Griffin, and with the politics of cronyism and financial corruption, financial and moral corruption that had taken root at the top of that party. Party that had once been a great hope for the British people under its founder, John Tyndall, the late John Tyndall, who died in 2005, who was a great political and personal friend and ally of mine. In those days, the BNP was a great party and was going somewhere. However, it was derailed due to problems within. So that was part of the problem. And the BNP has now almost entirely collapsed and disappeared from the political scene here in the UK. The other part of the problem is that while all that was going on, UKIP was gathering strength, and now the UKIP bandwagon, if you like, sweeps every other form of right-wing politics before it. So there's a handful of people, a handful of good people, still flying the flag for the National Front and the British Democratic Party, which is a new party, in various parts of England, a post-BNP politics, if you like, for racial nationalists, is starting to be constructed. But that's in its very early stages. It's in a handful of areas. We can just hope for a handful of decent results so that something is there to be rebuilt from the wreckage that's been left behind by the collapse of the BNP. More positively, the potential for racial nationalist politics is very, very clear. And part of UKIP's success reflects that potential. I accept there are some people who vote UKIP because they're solely concerned about the threat to sovereignty posed by the European Union. But a very large amount of the UKIP vote consists of people who potentially would vote for a more serious, radical form of racial nationalism. Now, after Thursday, many people who vote UKIP will have been built up by press coverage to think that Thursday is going to be the political earthquake, that UKIP will be the answer to all their problems. If that doesn't happen on Thursday, and if UKIP then itself becomes divided between people who are within UKIP, there are tendencies a bit like the difference between in the US the paleoconservatives and the neoconservatives and the libertarians. All of those strands are present within UKIP. So what one might term the paleoconservative or more racially conscious, racially realistic wing within UKIP may find itself embroiled within internal tensions and internal discussions within that party after Thursday's election. Whether UKIP wins one seat, half a dozen seats.
I was going to say, isn't the leadership of UKIP suppressing anybody who brings up real issues such as the Jewish problem or other racial nationalist issues?
Very much so. In fact, just 2 days ago, up in my part of the country, up in Lancashire, a UKIP parliamentary candidate was suspended from the party because of things that he'd written about the Jewish question. Relatively mild things he'd written, but things that he'd written on his website, on his Facebook site. And he was suspended because of the way that the British electoral law works. He is still on the ballot paper as a UKIP candidate, but formally the party has withdrawn its recognition from him. But it's just too late from the legal point of view for them to stop him being on the ballot paper as a UKIP candidate. That's one example, and there have been a number of others across the country of people at local level who've been silenced or been expelled. And for example, UKIP has a policy of not accepting anybody who's ever been a member of the British National Party. So, if I wanted to be a member of UKIP, I couldn't be, because I'm an ex-member of the BNP. They do allow people who, going way back into the politics of the 1970s, people who were in the National Front in the 1970s are allowed to be in UKIP because that was deemed a long time ago. But just as long as they say, oh, well, we made a mistake in the 70s and we're not going to talk about forbidden issues today. But certainly the Jewish question, or even sort of more radical comments on racial questions, just would not be allowed within UKIP. It gets worse than that, because at least UKIP has some sort of strong stance on immigration, but there is a wing of UKIP that would actually welcome some forms of immigration and is economically and socially libertarian. Again, as I say, reflecting something vaguely similar to a British version of the debates between paleoconservatives, neoconservatives, and libertarians within the American conservative movement, within things like the Tea Party movement. Those different strains are present within UKIP. And one interesting question, Nigel Farage, who's very much the leader of UKIP and very much the best-known public face of the party, he has said he will stand down as leader if he doesn't win the election in the constituency of Thanet down in the southeast of England, where he's standing on Thursday. If he doesn't win that constituency, he will stand down as leader. That could trigger an attempt at a more socially liberal takeover of the party, which again would open up an awful lot of political space. Where would more traditionally minded, more paleo-conservative types of people within UKIP, where would they go to if their party was taken over by libertarians? After Thursday will be an interesting time politically for our movement, even though it's the weakest our movement has ever been electorally in terms of the ballot papers on Thursday.
I was going to say, I suppose that the British press chimes in like the American press does anytime there's perceived political scandal on a candidate or a person that's on the right, the nationalist type. You know, they make it big news, but if there's somebody on the left, they'll do a cover-up. And it's just the way the press is used to push their agenda.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Mike. There is this demonizing agenda that the British press have. We have nationwide newspapers in this country mostly rather than regional newspapers, and they're owned by a very small number of people. Some of them are now, of course, owned by Russian oligarchs, or not ethnically Russian, but people who came from the East, and others are owned by big-time international operators like Rupert Murdoch, who have big investments in and big ties to Israel. So people of that internationalist outlook may promote a form of conservatism, but it's very much a limited form of conservatism, and anyone who strays beyond those boundaries is demonized. To give an example, just a few weeks ago there was quite a big meeting here in London, held in a hotel in central London, that discussed had international speakers covering a range of radical ideas, historical and philosophical and political ideas, including from your own country, Professor Kevin MacDonald and Mark Webber from the IHR. And that was treated a week later in the national press in this country with big articles as though some terrible Nazi event had taken place. The headlines were Nazi invasion of London, and as though some absolutely horrific extremist thing had happened, and with calls for the prosecution of people who'd organized this event. And of course, one of the problems here in the UK, as in numerous European countries in different forms, there are laws here in the UK, and have been since the 1960s, that place quite severe restrictions on what you're allowed to say about racial topics. One of the disturbing things is that the Labour Party leader, Ed Miliband, who is himself the son of Jewish communist immigrants from Europe. His late father was quite a well-known Marxist philosopher and writer. And this man, Ed Miliband, is the guy who's likely to be prime minister of this country, quite possibly, in a few days' time as leader of the Labour Party. He has pledged that those laws will be strengthened if Labour is in power after Thursday. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see us move closer to the even more restrictive laws that are present in some European countries, where in numerous European countries, if you just question the history of the 1940s, that is termed Holocaust denial, and you can go to prison for several years. In Germany, in Austria, in France, you're more likely to face a crippling fine, but in numerous countries in Europe, in more than 10 countries across Europe, there are laws of this type. So far in the United Kingdom, we don't have a specific law, say, banning discussion of 1940s history in that way. We don't have a so-called Holocaust denial law. But I can see us moving closer in that direction. And of course, one of the big issues in this country, the one area, very suspiciously, the one area where the mainstream media does talk about immigration is in talking up any issues to do with so-called militant Islam, to do with Muslims. Now, the reason I say this is suspicious is that to talk about immigration solely in terms of a so-called militant Islamic threat in this country, of course, serves the interests of Islam's biggest enemy. It serves those interests in two respects. First of all, it serves the direct interests of the State of Israel, because many so-called militant Islamic activities are activities that are anti-Zionist, that are hostile to the interests of the State of Israel. So if they can persuade the British people that their big enemies are just Muslims, then they can say, well, my enemy's enemy is my friend, therefore Israel must be our friend. And then it can push certain conservatively minded people, if they believe the media's agenda, they can be pushed down the same road that has so successfully been pushed, the same trick that's been pushed on Americans via the Christian Zionist movement.
And traditionally, the Arabs were our friends back in the days of Lawrence of Arabia and forward, but until we started having a foreign policy that favored the Jews and both their financial money interests and war interests, they weren't really our enemies at that time.
Yeah, for many, many decades there was, and the tragedy is that enmity was put in place at just the time when it would have been in the interests of America and of Britain to build on those traditional friendships in the Arab world, because of course oil was becoming important in the middle of the 20th century. And instead of building on those friendships, they were put at risk and destroyed, which for a while benefited the Soviet Union, now has benefited all sorts of chaotic movements that we don't quite know who's behind them. In the so-called ISIS movement, the so-called Islamic State movement, whoever's behind all of that, have fed off a hostility to the West that's really been engendered to begin with by our own actions in betraying our old friendships in that region in favor of a closer and closer alliance with the Zionist state in Israel since its creation in 1948. That hasn't been, aside from the moral question of betraying people who'd previously been our friends, it hasn't been in our economic interests, in our financial interests, because it's put at risk this relationship with the oil producing areas. There was an interesting thing I was referring to just the other day when you probably saw the U.S. Vice President confirming a few days ago, groveling again to the Israeli lobby and promising them these F-35 jets in a new arms deal. Now, if you go back to 1969, the government papers are actually available, the documents are available when the Nixon administration had just been elected. The Pentagon and various experts were saying to Nixon, look, we've got leverage here on Israel over the nuclear question. We've got a problem here where Israel has been secretly developing a nuclear weapon and refusing to be part of the nuclear non-proliferation talks. And here we are about to deliver what was in those days the F-4, the F-4 Phantoms, to Israel as part of a long-standing arms deal. We've got leverage that we can potentially use on Israel by saying, cut back the nuclear program, come into the non-proliferation talks, and don't escalate the whole military situation in the Middle East by developing nuclear weapons. We've got this leverage, why don't we use it? And they were talking about using it, then Golda Meir comes over to the United States, pulls a few media strings, and suddenly Nixon's abandoned that idea, and the F-4 Phantom jet deal went ahead. And from that day to this, no U.S. administration, and no British administration for that matter, has sought to exercise any meaningful leverage on Israel on the nuclear question, while we talk incessantly about the so-called threat from other countries developing nuclear weapons. Israel is the one country that's been given a free pass every time across the decades.
I'm afraid that the Republican Party in this country would be even worse than the Democrats as far as getting us in a war with Iran, the Jewish enemy.
Yeah, I think part of the problem there is the big money that's wielded, it's certainly in U.S. politics by people like this guy Sheldon Adelson, who just the one man there has enormous power over the question of who becomes the Republican candidate.
They not only are able to use our troops and our men to kill their enemies, but they're making a tremendous amount off of war profits. It's always been that way throughout history.
Yeah, and of course, in terms of the broader populace, they get at them from two angles. They get at them from the Christian Zionist angle through the pulpit, and they get at many younger people especially through control of the media, the entertainment media, the broadcast media, through sometimes subtle messages being put out and sometimes blatant control over political discussion. You know, it's the same over racial questions as well. You travel around London and just things like posters to advertise theatrical productions or to advertise commercial products, all of the time an agenda is being pushed, a multiracialist agenda is being pushed, so that people think it's perfectly normal and indeed desirable to go further and further in that direction of miscegenation, of multiracialism, and that any healthy regard for racial solidarity and cultural traditions is either politically extremist or just old-fashioned and not modern, not something that young people would want to be interested in.
Of course, that's being pushed in the movies and the television, and people think that what's portrayed there is accurate historical history. It's just a terrible distortion, but they believe it to be true.
Yeah.
Let me give our phone number out again right here. It's 877-924-7722. That's a toll-free number, 877-924-7722, 877-YAWS-RACE. Or if either foreign or domestic callers would like to dial direct, dial 678-949-5091. I'd like to ask your opinion or your understanding on the nationalist parties in Europe. I know that there's been a public dispute between the Le Pens, father and daughter, in France, and I know that some of the other parties are more active than in past years in some of the other European countries.
That's right. Well, essentially, right across Europe, the big dividing line is what we were just discussing a moment ago, those parties that become obsessed by the Islamic threat, and those parties that see a broader racial struggle and are prepared to talk about fundamental issues like the Jewish question. Now, the party that's in the balance on this, and which is also the most successful racial nationalist party in Europe, is the French Front National. The reason that's in the balance on it is that it contains both people who have a traditional attitude on racial questions and are prepared to talk about the Jewish question, and also other tendencies in that party would prefer to move in the direction of talking solely about Islam. And it's those more liberal tendencies in certain respects that are becoming very influential on the new leader, Marine Le Pen. Perhaps not so much Marine Le Pen's personal attitude, but the people who she's prepared to listen to and who are saying we should move much closer to some of the parties in places like Flanders, in Belgium, in Holland, and in Austria. Those are the three parties that are very, very, the three countries where nationalists are particularly obsessed by Islam. Some of Marine Le Pen's advisers are saying that's the way to go, to move away from traditional racial questions and certainly not mention the Jewish question. As it happens, a number of those people advising Marine Le Pen are also socially liberal on some other questions, such as homosexuality. There's been a suggestion that there's a sort of secret homosexual lobby within the Front National at very high levels, within the groups of people who are advising Marine Le Pen. But be that as it may, what they're certainly doing is advising very much on an obsessive focus on Islam. And the people who are more traditionally minded in the FN are rallying around Jean-Marie Le Pen, her father, and also on at the other generational end, on Marine Le Pen's niece, Marion Maréchal Le Pen, who's only in her mid-20s, who's the youngest MP in France, and who may carry forward, be the standard bearer, carry forward Jean-Marie Le Pen's agenda of traditional nationalism. I think that debate will continue for some time inside the FN. The problem of Marine Le Pen's current stance will be having tried to force through a more liberalizing stance, having picked an argument with her own father, and possibly try and begin to force her own father out of the party. If she's not very careful, that could actually split the FN and could be the one, the great success the FN has had is in being, if you like, a broad church party that contained many tendencies within it. If that party splits, that could significantly weaken it in the elections to come in France over the next few years. For example, the FN has always included a strong Christian tendency within it, but also a strong secular tradition within it. If those two groups begin to fall out, that could pull the party into pieces. Now, that may, of course, be what certain forces want to see. They want to see nationalist parties weaken their political stance and tear themselves apart. You can well imagine the type of people who would want to see that, and it would be a tragedy if Europe's most successful nationalist party were to either weaken its stance beyond recognition or to tear itself apart over internal personality faction fights.
I understand that in Hungary and Greece, the establishment government is passing laws and doing other things to suppress the racial nationalist parties in those countries.
It's truly shocking. It's truly shocking. I mean, Greece is a particularly extreme example of that, where a very radical nationalist party, Golden Dawn, came from a microscopically small base, where they were, you know, they were allied to forces such as the National Alliance in the US, the British movement here in Britain, but were very much at the political margins. But partly due to economic crisis and partly due to their own determined stance on defending the interests of the Greek people, Golden Dawn advanced from complete political insignificance to polling 10% of the vote there and getting a substantial block of MPs and MEPs. The reaction of the Greek establishment was twofold. On the one hand, they tried to bring legal prosecutions and new laws against Golden Dawn's leaders, several of whom were locked up in prison. And on the other end of the scale, they unleashed the forces of political violence, and two prominent activists from Golden Dawn were shot dead outside their party headquarters in Greece. So that's the two-pronged assault of the establishment, their legal wing and their radical left violent wing. The leaders of Golden Dawn and the ordinary people of Greece have shown tremendous bravery in sticking to the task of building their movement and making further advances for their movement in recent years. Of course, now the far left is in coalition in Greece and is wanting to bring forward even further anti-nationalist laws. We just have to hope that we don't see the same thing when the left wing, if the left wing, take over on Thursday in Britain. In Hungary is another good example of a radical party that's polled very well there. The Jobbik Party is a significant force there. In Hungary, it's not a left-wing government that brings in oppressive laws. It's actually a nominally conservative government that brings in laws there to repress radical nationalist stances. So it's not always just the far left who pursue an authoritarian agenda that suppresses debate. It can often be conservatives as well. In fact, sometimes they can be the worst.
There in Britain, the Conservative Party is afraid of losing its members to UKIP, and it's similar in the other countries. You mentioned a little while ago about the Christian roots of some of the nationalist parties in Europe. Just yesterday on the BBC, I heard the rise of atheist Sunday gatherings over in your country, and while church attendance is declining and the major churches like the Anglican Church have compromised traditional Christian teachings in order to become politically correct, what is the spiritual and social environment both in Great Britain and Europe?
Yes, well, as your question implies, the crisis of the churches in Britain is to a large extent self-inflicted. The spiritual vacuum in many people's lives here has just been further heightened by the tendency for the churches to pursue obsessively a politically correct agenda. So you will not hear a moral message about how to live your own life in this country that you would have heard 50 years or more ago from the Christian churches here. What you will hear is a constant message about aid to the third world, about multiracialism, an ultra-liberal attitude on issues of personal morality in the mainstream churches, particularly in the Church of England here. And of course, due to the recent election of Pope Francis, an increasingly liberal line taken by the Roman Catholic Church as well. It's really traditional morality has now been confined to the margins of organized religion in this country, to a handful of brave souls such as Bishop Richard Williamson of the Traditionalist Catholic Society of St. Pius X, who is, again, Bishop Williamson is facing prosecution in Germany for the things that he's been prepared to say. They actually have tried to issue arrest warrants. They've not yet issued a European arrest warrant to seize him here. But if he were to set foot in Germany, the German courts would want to haul him before the courts and they're even trying him in his absence there in Germany. That's how far we've gone in terms of the surrender to an alien agenda right across Europe. Now, of course, in Britain as well, the churches face a huge battle against a secularizing agenda in the media. But their response to that battle has been, for the most part, from the point of view of the church leadership, has been surrender to the values behind secularization. And that has just heightened the spiritual vacuum in people's lives. And I'm sure leads to, is part of the reason why you get young people going off into all sorts of odd directions with drug abuse, with all sorts of other peculiar directions that young people head to in their lives because of a lack of leadership from the churches. The paradox is that one of the few forces to stand up against a secularizing liberal agenda in this country is Islam. The immigrant populations here certainly the Islamic populations here take a more traditional, socially conservative line on issues of personal morality than the organized churches do.
And that's a shame.
It's tragedy.
Not that they have to wear a burqa or anything, but at least they're modest compared to a lot of the girls in this country, and I guess over there, you're dressing like the whores used to dress.
Exactly right. I mean, it's a bizarre situation that people wonder why there's a lack of respect, why young women are treated in our city centres are treated inappropriately sometimes in night spots in our city centres. But it's hardly surprising when they choose to dress like only a generation ago whores would have dressed. And, of course, this is the pressure that's been put on them for a very, very young age to portray themselves in that way. And it's also, of course, no surprise at the very extreme and most horrific end of things that there's been in the last generation or so an epidemic of abuse of very young people, and in some cases of children. And we've seen just in the last year or so, some absolutely horrific scandals of that sort just beginning to come to light. Most infamously, a Labour politician called Lord Janner, who was Greville Janner, Labour MP, and who was head of the biggest Jewish organisation in the UK, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, was very well known in the World Jewish Congress for numerous international Zionist campaigns. There's now the only reason why he's not in the dock facing serious charges of homosexual child abuse of young boys is that his lawyers are arguing that he is too old and too ill and suffering senile dementia, so wouldn't be capable of answering the charges in court. It's been commented rather ironically that only a few months ago he was compos mentis enough to sign paperwork for his role in the House of Lords, but now when these serious criminal charges, when the police have raided his home and wanting to bring charges against him, he's said to be suffering from senile dementia. The real question, of course, is those charges, those specific charges, were talked about more than 20 years ago for the first time. Were talked about by people who were themselves in court, who mentioned these allegations in court more than 20 years ago. He denied those allegations then, and the authorities failed to proceed against him. So really the question is, why was there such a successful cover-up against this powerful man, this man who was head of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, big role in the World Jewish Congress? He was protected at the time when he could have faced criminal charges, and now the stories are only being talked about now at a stage when he's said to be too old and too ill to face criminal charges. That says something pretty horrific about the state of affairs in this country, something pretty horrific about the lack of protection.
same powers that be. Well, we're actually at the end of the broadcast. It's been very interesting. Would you like to make a concluding remark, and then we'll have to sign off?
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you for all the listeners who've tuned in tonight. I think there's, on the one hand, a depressing aspect of a lack of attention by political elites to fundamental issues. There's a more positive aspect that increasing numbers of ordinary people, thanks to new media, thanks to the internet, thanks to independent radio shows, independent websites, are beginning to discuss important issues outside of the mainstream. UKIP in this country is to some extent a reflection of the public demand for discussion of political issues outside the mainstream. Our role has got to be to build on that, to take it further, to bring some hope for our people on both sides of the Atlantic. There are signs of hope. Let's build on those.
Well, thank you again, Peter, and we'll have to have you back again in the future.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.